In Spain, the majority of these people would not use that word to describe themselves, right? Like the, I guess the French in Rojava would call themselves democratic confederalists or apoists, or that they are inspired by the writings of Abdullah Öcalan. There are anarchists within the revolution, like TA, right? And I think one of the things that I really want to, and to borrow a phrase from Graeber in a second here, I want to ham on is what Graeber called the loser left, right? Like, people who thought that a revolution could never succeed and they're incapable of conceiving of it succeeding, so they just spend their time attacking the ones that have, rather than being there in solidarity. And what I got from the folks in TA was that they are there to provide solidarity, and sometimes even a critique, but a critique from a place of solidarity, right? Not a critique from a place of I can't help but think there's some kind of colonial relationship to the condescension of seeing American people on the internet, attack the friends in Rojava for not being anarchist in this way or that way, while the friends are trying to work out how to administer society in the midst of one of the most brutal wars of the 21st century, right? So where these places differ, and they do, and I can talk about this idea of having commanders in certain fashions but not having status that accrues to that. They do sometimes do so for important reasons, also because maybe that's not what they're going for, right? That's not, that they would not say that, we're here to enact anarchism. They would talk about liberation, and they are pursuing liberation in the way that makes the most sense to them. But where we make criticisms, we should do it from a place of solidarity, not a place of condescension and sometimes just misunderstanding, right? I have been there, but I am not always there. I do not have the grasp of the situation that they do, and I trust that they are people who believe in the same things, broadly speaking, that I do, and that they are pursuing those in a way that makes the most sense to them. But yeah, to give this one concrete example, right, which was very interesting, and in that it came up in all the things that I studied, or all the things that I wrote about, was this idea that in the moment of combat, it is beneficial to have one person who can make decisions on behalf of the group, because there is not time to deliberate, discuss, and achieve consensus, right? If you're going to go left or go right, you have to decide. If you're being ambushed, you have to decide. You have very little time. And so what most of them said was that in a situation like that, they will have a person who they decide is going to be in charge, and that person is going to make decisions on behalf of the group. But that it is very important that that person does not accrue status outside of that moment of combat, right? Or of that mission, or of that action that they have decided to place that person in that position for. I.e., it's not like a status rank, right? No one is saluting them the rest of the time. I remember, I'd always ask them, oh, do you guys salute? And their response is generally, certainly in Rojava, if someone is saluting, it's a joke. They're mocking, or they're having a laugh, versus, that's integral to the discipline culture of militaries in the United States or another, sort of more conventional militaries, I suppose. So they do have the situation where they have something that almost appears like absolute authority, right? A person who makes the decisions that the others then follow. But that person is still accountable to those people and can be changed or removed by those people. But the exigencies of combat mean that it is most efficient and safer for everyone if somebody makes those decisions on behalf of the group while that is ongoing.
So a lot of historical examples of anarchist organization of violence, usually it would come as, maybe the attentat of one individual going out and doing propaganda of the deed in order to influence other people, an assassination, mm-hmm. Maybe a rural insurrection in Malatesta's days, or possibly a guerrilla outfit, some sort of mm-hmm. affinity group of pistoleros, sort of what Rudy was doing alongside his other comrades. But I guess one of the things that you talk about in this, to point back to that line from The New Anarchists, is not being able to imagine mm-hmm. that anarchists could organize violence in a more coordinated, larger manner, even if they had desired to. We should leave this to the state communists. Can you talk about some of the dilemmas around the idea of an anarchist army and the forms that you saw that tension take in conflicts that you present in against the state?
Yeah, definitely. So this is kind of the fundamental sort of question I wanted to answer, right? Is how do they move from that guerrilla or affinity model to a big formation? that has logistics, has all these things. You know, this is, again, like a discussion that only really happens on the internet, but like people seem to think that anarchists can't do logistics or any sort of organization at scale, and like anarcho-syndicalism is right there, actually. Mm. And it's pretty well documented. And so they do that, right? Like, perhaps the best kind of most well easily structured example is in the anarchist columns in Spain, where they generally have units of 10, which then elect a delegate, not a representative, right, but a delegate to a centuria of 100. And then the centuria elects a delegate who then goes to the group, and then the group elects delegates who go to the column, which has then its war committee, right? So that is how they approach the, like, you know, how do we, because they it is not possible to organize consensus, right, across thousands of people spread across dozens of miles of front line, some of whom are being shot at all times. So that is how they're able to comply with what they consider to be like egalitarian and consensus-based organizing without having everybody get in one place where they could also just be, it'd be horrendous sort of, you present a very large target, right, if you get everyone in one place, not very smart move. So that is how they deal with that. There are some wonderful discussions between Durruti and Emma Goldman that I talk about in the book, where he talks about this, right? And he's been an anarchist his whole life and doesn't want to become a general. You know, he doesn't want to die as an officer, having been committed his whole life to organizing horizontally. And so a lot of what they rely on is what they call duty, right? Deber is the Spanish word. The idea that people will comply with their duty if because this is their duty both to each other and they have a sense of historical duty, I think, as well, right? That is what will motivate people. There is still a question of discipline, and it's one, like, I spend a lot of time on the book, like, what do you do when someone doesn't, right? And there are examples of that. Somebody who I met who had been part of the SDF, the Syrian Democratic Forces, talked about a time when a member of their unit had not been present with the unit at a time when they were supposed to be, and that had put other people in danger and led to other people having to do extra stuff. And so when that person came back, they all sat down together and they discussed an appropriate sanction. And with that person's consent, they arrived at a sanction, right? So that was how, in that case, they sort of, because you have to kind of make sure that everyone can rely on everyone at a bigger scale than like the affinity group. You know, you know you can rely on everyone because it's such a small group. But how do you do that at scale? It's through things like this. I think it's also through a genuine commitment, right? That everybody feels like they're pushing in a direction that is important and that they're willing to be there. That's the other thing, right? Nobody has joined these revolutions because they need college money and they can't afford it. No one has joined because they don't want to go to jail. No one has joined because they come from a small town and there is no other economic opportunity, right? There are many reasons that lead to people joining conventional militaries. Those aren't really present. It's my community is under attack, or I'm here to participate in this revolution because I think it will make the world better. That is the case in all of these, right? So in a sense, that therefore becomes less of a problem. But the way that they generally organize things, for instance, in the CNT, is along the same lines that they organized everything else through workers' committees, right? Just the same way they organized. An example I delved into, my editor and I sort of debated whether we should leave this in or not, but I tried to leave most of it in, was the construction of Tiznaus, which is a, how would I describe it? Like an up-armored vehicle, a rudimentary tank. Things are like kind of iconic.
They're amazing. They're so fun to look at.
I bought this, I don't know where it is now, but I bought this incredible book that was like, in the like early 2000s and late 90s, there were magazines that one could get, right? And you would get like one a month for a year and they would send a small part of a thing and you would construct the item over time. So there was one magazine such as that in Spain dedicated entirely to like these Tiznaus. And I have bought the annuals for like, possibly like one of like five copies that still exist, right? And it to my mind, is the most authoritative work on these incredible machines, right? But it took less than a week from when the coup began to when boiler factories in Barcelona were churning out rudimentary tanks. And they weren't very good, right? But some of the, over time, they iterated and they improved things, right? And the way they improved things was not because there was a profit motive, but because there was a motive that was more important to them, which was defeating Franco, right? Franco wasn't in charge at that point, but defeating the Spanish military, right? And so like when one person worked out, huh, if you put a grill on the front, they don't overheat. Okay, but they can shoot through the grill. Well, what if we put two grills opposed to each other? Air can still pass through, but bullets can't. Okay. Now everyone's doing that because, like, I have to file a patent and extract income from it. I can immediately share this with everyone who's doing this, right? So we see this really rapid development of these vehicles, which is remarkable. It didn't need somebody, it didn't need a commissar in the factories to come in and threaten to send people to the gulag. They didn't do it, right? And one of the things that really interests me about 3D printing is that like the majority of the stuff, right, if you go onto one of the 3D printing websites, people are not extracting income from. They've made it because they needed it or someone they knew needed it, and they're happy to share it with the world in case they need it too. And like that in a sense is, it's not devoid of capitalism because these websites that host the files and things, like there's capitalism happening. But the impulse there to make something and to do innovation for the betterment of mankind, and it's sometimes like, yeah, they're making the battery cover for the remote control on your TV. I understand that that's not like directly the betterment of mankind, but if people are making things, they're being creative in a way that capitalism tells us isn't possible, right? That they're not innovating for profit. They're just innovating because it's something that they have a passion for and they want to share it with the world. And so that always interested me about 3D printing, right? When it started, I thought that was really cool in a world where increasingly, like, you know, everything is a subscription-based service. This wasn't. This was just people sharing things. And so when I saw the 3D printed guns, that made me think of the, like this model in Spain, right, where Spanish workers were also making firearms, right? When the Basque country started to lose, some of its factories were bombed in Guernica, or some towns were lost where these factories were. Right? Basque workers came to Catalonia and made pistols, sometimes with Francisco Ascaso's name on them. Right, like this, it's maybe the only like anarchist like branded firearm to exist in human history. But again, right, like it was this really fascinating way of organizing that I think if we've read about anarcho-syndicalism, it makes sense. But I don't know why people didn't think it could apply to war when we had examples of it happening.
I mean, it just makes me think of like the free and open source software movement. Also, yeah. Like people are constantly putting in work to create and keep updated and working in forums or collaborating to keep updated and improve on all of these apps and programs that are alternatives to the subscription payment thing. Not because they're getting anything out of it necessarily. Oftentimes, like they might have a secondary job that's working in this industry, but they use their free time to be like, hey, here's something I can share with people. This is awesome.
Yeah, actually, the community where I first met one of the sources from my book is called FOSCAD, Free and Open Source Computer Aided Design. I think that's what CAD stands for. That very much is a good dovetail, I think.
The military order of the nation state is lauded as efficient in not only its destructive force, but also its creative. For instance, shaping its constituents, the soldiers, through structured violence. Like they talk in the U.S. about going to boot camp, you get broken down and reconstructed in mm-hmm. the way that the army wants you to be. Can you talk about left libertarian debates on militarization and discipline? You've spoken a little bit about discipline and el deber in the historical moments that you explore in the book. But if you could talk a little bit about like the imposition of that structure and the fighting back against that sort of model.
Yeah, so the clearest place where we see this again is in Spain, right, with the militarization or regularization of these anarchist columns. And the way that was enforced was by withholding pay and withholding weapons, right? The anarchists in Spain, as with much of the Republic, went into the war with an absolutely chaotic bunch of weapons, right? Often you'd have people fighting alongside each other with completely different weapons, completely different rounds, so that, you know, it made logistics a nightmare, right? If you're literally dozens of different types of bullets needed for a single unit, right? And they'd have to source those and then distribute those and absolute chaos. So the withholding of weapons was a big deal. And this causes a debate among the anarchists, right? But also, like, they have made mistakes. You can see this sometimes in like the newspaper, the Durruti column, where they're being like, hey, you can't just start an attack by yourself, guys. We got to work together on this, right? Or like, don't just be shooting. Like, check in with everyone else before you start sending, you know, rounds down range. So they are thinking like, can we be better? That is clearly part of that discussion. What they have as a benefit is that like anyone can have an idea, and that idea can quickly become implemented in a way that it probably couldn't if that person, you know, was considered to be of too low rank or status, right? So we see them using, for instance, like anti-aircraft, like flak cannons in direct fire configurations, which is really interesting to me, because this was a very common tactic, the Germans in World War II, the Nazis in World War II, I should say, but not so much before that. I don't know when it began, but this is one of the first documented instances I can find. And so I'm really interested in the Durruti column of doing this in 1936, right? They're being like, hey, this gun that's supposed to shoot in the air and then drop down an aircraft or land, you know, arc down and drop on people, what if we just pointed it at them? It's not rocket science, but the way that they were using that was very effective. And so, like, that is to their advantage, right? But by the end of 1936, they're clearly having this discussion about how do we meet this moment? Because the rest of the Republic is becoming increasingly controlled by the Soviet Union and increasingly dominated by the Soviet extremely authoritarian model, right? Like, even compared, like, when we look at the Russian military, which kind of uses that model, if you look at a Western military, right, let's say the United States military or the British military, the role of junior leaders, right, what they were called, you know, your corporals, lance corporals, things like this, isn't just to enforce the orders, right? They also do some actual leadership decision making on a very small scale, right? And this, with your sergeants and you know, going up as the rank increases, the scale of the decision making they would be doing would increase. But in the Soviet military, the role of those people was just to punish people who stepped out of line, right? To enforce the orders from above. They did not make decisions. They enforced other people's decisions. So even amongst conventional militaries, this was a particularly authoritarian one. And we see this in the way the international brigadiers loathed the commissars who were in their units. Called them comic stars a lot, I guess. But the anarchists don't want this, right? And it, like I quote extensively from some pieces of writing at the time, but there are meetings and debates, right? And different units come to different sort of, I guess, consensuses, or come to different solutions, or different... Some of them are not consensuses, right? Like, the unit militarizes, but people leave because they're unwilling to militarize, right? Some of them are like, hey, what if the people who we've elected are delegates, what if we let them wear the badge like they were a lieutenant? But we still treated each other like friends, like equals. And some of them say, I think we need this stuff. That's how everyone else does war. And, you know, we haven't really fought at this scale before. So maybe this is how you got to do it. And some of them are like, no, f*** that, we're not doing it. You know, like the Iron Column. And then in the anarchist encyclopedia, I think it is, it describes them as rabid in their anarchism, right? their refusal to accept hierarchy. They called the little badges of rank that people would get sardines, because they were kind of shiny. And so they'd be like, oh, these people keep turning up with sardines, and like, we don't give a shit. Like, we're the Iron Column. Like, we accept, you know, we've no gods, no masters, right? Like, and they sent a detachment back from the front lines because they didn't have weapons, and the police in the rear did. So they were going to assault the cops and take their weapons, right? Because they felt that they were more useful at the front. So they continue to pursue this more, I guess, like hardcore approach, or like their commitment to no gods, no masters is absolute. And so we see different like settlements, I guess, throughout both in Spain and across history.
The Files for Radio is a proud member of the Channel Zero Network of Anarchist Podcasts, and here's a jingle from another member of CZN.
Hello, Inman here from Strangers in a Tangled Wilderness, an anarchist publishing collective that's been putting out work for over 20 years. We just put out a new book, and we think you're really going to like this one. Orso, Wartime Journals of an Anarchist, contains the first-person narrative of Lorenzo Orsetti, also known as Heval Tekocher Peling, now Shahid Tekocher, an internationalist soldier in Rojava. Orso's journals were originally published in their native Italian following his death, and we have the great honor of publishing the first English edition. It's through our devotion to each other that we, all of us, live forever. This memoir is a story of the everyday bravery that not only defeated the Islamic State, but proved that a better world is possible and within our grasp. That's what Margaret Kiljoy had to say about the book. What will you say about it? If you want a sneak peek for free, you can read the essay Martyr Culture by Sarah Bloom, which accompanies and helps contextualize Orso's journals. You can also hear an audio feature of the essay, as well as my interview with Sarah about her essay on the Strangers in a Tangled Wilderness podcast, or Live Like the World is Dying. Find it all at tangledwilderness.org. And remember, every storm begins with a single raindrop. Try to be that raindrop. Or so.
If you want to support the Final Straw Radio, you can subscribe to our podcast via various streaming platforms, follow, rate, and share our materials online, and learn more at tfsr.media. And if you'd like to fund our transcription work that allows for easier translation, more accessibility of content, and the zines that we produce for each interview, consider picking up some merch from us or making a one-time or recurring donation via PayPal, Stripe, Venmo, or LibrePay. Or joining our Patreon to access early release content and other goodies via the links that you can find at tfsr.media/support. Finally, if you'd like to hear us on your local radio station, visit tfsr.media/radio to find more info or reach out to us for some help. Thanks for listening.
One thing that we keep coming back to when we talk about Spain is the influence of the Soviet as like this one national formation or whatever you want to call it, union, that is willing to offer weapons, leadership training in exchange for gold, I guess. But and I think that there's never too many times that somebody breaks down sort of the Stalinist influence on the revolution in Spain and the civil war in Spain. Mm-hmm. Would you mind briefly doing that? Just like what this meant for the revolution there and the revolutionaries of all different stripes, and in particular what it meant for non-Stalinists?
Yeah, so I think we start out, this doesn't have to be the case. I think it's really important that Spain was not a communist country, that Soviet communism, Marxism-Leninism generally, was not a significant force in Spain on the eve of the revolution, right? It existed in Catalonia, it barely existed. In the rest of Spain, it did exist, but it was not the predominant means of organizing on the left. We then see the quote-unquote democracies, right? Britain, France, the United States, very quickly abandon the people of Spain as they continue with their appeasement strategy, what they call it. Spain is non-intervention, right? I think the US sent, and early on, some weapons were sent. I think somebody got some handguns out of the embassy. And at one point, they're sending a plane and there's a filibuster on non-intervention in the Senate until that plane can take off. But like, we're talking about a single aircraft here, right? What happens, and this is a debate, right? Like I've read a lot about non-intervention because it's the moment that liberal democracy allows fascism to happen, right? The world would look fundamentally different if these democracies had intervened in
Spain.
Well,
besides in Germany, where liberal democracy led but, fascism.
Yeah, I guess, yeah. And in Abyssinia and these other places. You get a lot of people, actually, you get a lot of young black Americans who have watched Abyssinia and be like, I'll get them back in Spain, and then we'll push on. The role, just to digress, I guess, the role of black Americans in the international brigades is very interesting to me. And even beforehand in the Popular Olympics, which I wrote a book about, the Catalan Popular Front is financing black people's travel to the Popular Olympics because they believe the anti-fascist struggle and the struggle for black liberation are one and the same. So like, it's not like these people do have criticisms of the US quote-unquote democratic model, especially the 1930s, right? But nonetheless, they're abandoned by people operating in that paradigm. And the Soviet Union, therefore, is the only place where Spain can get weapons. Now, what does the Soviet Union want? It wants gold, right? It wants a source of hard currency, especially, you know, it's still a relatively young state project, right? 20 years old by the second year of the Spanish Civil War. It doesn't have a lot of those gold reserves, right? Because they've left in the First World War under the Tsarist Russian government. So Spain, and there is a moment which I talk about in the book in which the anarchists had a plan to steal the gold and use that themselves, which they never enact. But the Spanish government, which has much of its gold in Paris at this time, starts sending the gold to Russia in return for weapons. Right, and what the Soviet Union first does is offload all of the weapons it captured in the First World War, like just random junk, right? Like old Italian rifles, just a whole hodgepodge of weapons. And then later it starts sending over other weapons. I have one on my wall over there, actually. The Mosin Nagant is like one of the more famous ones, right? At the same time, the Soviet Union starts sending over military advisors, and the people it sends are all operating under code names. Interestingly, you also have a number of white Russians who come over and fight at this time. And I think what they are seeking is, either in some cases they're committed to a revolution that is not Marxist-Leninist and they want to see that succeed and then push on to home. In many cases, I think they're seeking, like, if I do this, I've shown my commitment to the new regime, then I can go back and they'll let me live safely. Didn't work out that way.
And White Russians being a term, not like an ethnic term, but a term for reactionary forces that would have supported the Tsar initially, right?
Yeah, yes. Yeah, exactly. So you see a lot of people who have been in the Tsarist army come over to Spain. And perhaps some of them were in a sort of more, like, I guess what you would call a liberal democratic paradigm at the time, and therefore sort of interested in Spain. But overwhelmingly what you see are the Soviet Union sending its generals, who again, like, are operating under pseudonyms with fake passports and such, but they begin to assume command, right? They're supposed to be advisors, but they're very clearly not. And you see the Soviet Union sending equipment, right? And you, this is the first modern combined arms war, right? The fighting we see at the very end of the First World War, it's maybe like this, but this is where we start to see, like, this is where Nazi Germany develops its blitzkrieg, right? It's using aircraft, it's using tanks, and it's using infantry together to move quickly and to seize large areas of ground before people have time to set up defensive, right? You need tanks and you need aircraft for that, right? And if you don't have them, it doesn't matter. So at the start of the war, the Republic has most of the weapons and most of the people. Very quickly, Italy and Germany come in on the side of the Francoists, right? They're also signatories to the Non-Aggression Pact. They just don't care about lying. That's the thing with fascism. And so they are, like, when you said, right, when the Francoists came over from Morocco, it wasn't Spanish planes, right? It was planes provided to them by the fascists. And so the Republic needs weapons, and it needs military expertise, and it gets both of these from the Soviet Union. And very quickly, the Soviet Union also brings over the NKVD, right? And very quickly, we start to see this paranoid sort of purging of the ranks of the Republic, to include, by the way, many of these generals who had been bought over by the Soviets, you know, to command or advise, you know, Kleber being the most famous one, right? Like, he had orchestrated some incredible Republican victories, right? Like, genuinely remarkable feats at arms. And then sort of there became this this concept of Kleberism, like, where people were sort of accruing personal glory rather than being super monastic in their devotion to the revolution. And many of these generals who had, they may not have been politically aligned with the way the Republic was or the way I am, but they had orchestrated some, you know, the Battle of Madrid, right? These incredible feats ended up being purged back in Russia as well. But by 1937, the Spanish military intelligence is spending far, far more time purging its own ranks of people who have different types of leftism, right? The other one being the PUM, right? The Workers' Unification Marxist Party, which is an anti-Stalinist Marxist or non-Stalinist Marxist party. Incidentally, you will see in many texts the PUM referred to as Trotskyists. They are not. You can look at their letters of open disagreement with, you can see Trotsky writing to them and arguing with them. This is a Stalinist slander that they put upon them, right? As they began to purge and torture them and remove them. Of course, people will have read Orwell's book, Homage to Catalonia, and will be aware that by May of 1937, this manifests itself in open street fighting in Barcelona between the anarchists and the state. Because at that point, many anarchists felt that they had a choice of living under fascism and being pursued and hunted and eventually killed, or living under state communism and being pursued and hunted and eventually killed. And they thought that while they still had weapons in their hands, they should fight against either of those things, right? But the Soviet Union very quickly acquires all of Spain's gold, right? And then it is in theory pursuing this, like, Popular Front anti-fascist policy where it's not opposed to liberal democracy. But it becomes very clear that the Soviet Union, and gradually, like, as for instance, Largo Caballero is no longer prime minister, right? And so we have all these figures who had some degree of autonomy or who did not entirely owe their power to the Soviets are removed, and people who have no autonomy and who do entirely owe everything they have to the Soviets are installed. And it becomes, by the end, for many of these anarchists, like, a revolution not worth fighting for, because it is just another authoritarian state project. And they've seen what it will do, because it's already done it to them in the military, right? And it's catastrophic for the efficacy, right? And don't get me wrong, like many people still continue fighting to the very end, and many of them remain in the mountains afterwards and continue to resist fascism, right? But the spontaneity of the revolution and the real sort of like the liberation that it could have been is gone by 2 years into the war, because it has come to be dominated by this Soviet influence.
I could ask a million questions about that specifically. So that definitely, to say one way, hamstrung the revolutionary possibilities, or even just the survival of the Republic and the Republican forces. Yeah. And it's easy to look at this in retrospect. There's tons of books and scholarship that's written on this. With the two current struggles, I do not have the impression that the autonomous administration has been allowed to rely quite as heavily or anywhere near as heavily on the U.S., for instance. Like, the U.S. has done strategic bombing or unstrategic bombing, I guess kind of dumb bombing at times, and has provided small arms, but has not provided a lot of other weaponry that's been requested by the people of Rojava in order to defend, for instance, against Turkish drones. And it doesn't sound like there's any outside state that is, like, at this point aiding the movement in Myanmar and, like, the struggle there that would, like, be able to step in and sort of, like, swipe administrative control, right? So there's no, like, fair comparison.
Yeah. So at times you had like EROs that are dedicated to sort of the model that the CCP is now pursuing, right? And at times those EROs were able to, because they had access to better weapons, they were able to sort of influence the revolution. But now many of those EROs are returning land to the junta because they have been sort of called to alignment by China, right? Called to make peace or in certain places to return. So, for instance, this happened in one area in northeastern Myanmar recently where an ethnic revolutionary organization was asked to return a city to the junta, right? And then you have PDF units within just outside that city being like, yeah, well, we're still fighting. So if the junta wants to come past us, we will shoot at them. In that sense, the ideological capture or whatever, the sort of exercising control has not happened. And because you have zero state support, right, in any official form, you have the majority of the support that comes is like from the diaspora, right, from aligned people who just care about the cause. And those people are generally willing to support those people because they're fighting for liberation and they're not asking them to comply with any particular ideology. And I think in Rojava, like, I think if people are honest, they will ask you, right? Like, and I understand why they ask, because they have fought alongside American people in some cases, right? They have bled alongside them in some cases. And it is hard to understand, right, where when you've, you know, gone to a war, had this experience alongside people, they then abandon you when your children are dying in drone strikes, right? That is, it's a betrayal, and it's a very great betrayal. And I think for people who see their whole movement in terms of friendship, it can be hard to grasp that. But they also know that the Americans were not in this for the revolution. They were in it to defeat the Islamic State, right? Now, there are American service people whose entire political world has changed because of their time in Rojava and their experiences with the revolution. And that is wonderful. But I think they do understand that the United States is a state. And that in their analysis, you know, like the state is a project which maybe is incapable of solidarity with a people. And they would, you know, they would not see themselves as a state. And so they have retained like that ideological outlook. The Kurdish freedom movement as a whole, right, this group of sort of aligned groups in solidarity with each other that are inspired by the political thought of Abdullah Öcalan, has changed over time. And certainly, like, we see this with the PKK, right, which is a distinct organization from the SDF, but its ideology has changed based on Öcalan's ideology. But I think it's an excellent illustration of the differences between the two groups, which, you know, your average like SNA kind of shill will collapse, and that there will always, this is always a thing that you will see, right, that the YPG, YPJ are the same as the PKK. It's very demonstrably not the case, right? The PKK is laying down its weapons based on its movement to a new paradigm, they would say, like a new democratic paradigm. The SDF is categorically not laying down its weapons, right? So even in that sense, right, sometimes people see this movement as a monolith.
The SDF not just the ideologically like related to the Kurdish movement, right, or the PYD, right? SDF is more of a coalition. Yeah.
Yeah, the SDF is a coalition, so like you could look at the SDF as like the coalition that defends the AANES, the specifically aligned with the PYD philosophy would be the YPG and YPJ, right? The People's Protection Defense Forces and the Women's Defense Forces.
Sorry to cut you off on that. I was just
No, it's an alphabet soup of shit. So like it's between Spain, Myanmar and Rojava, like I made a very conscious effort to not use too many acronyms, and there are still several pages of acronyms.
And you also, have a glossary, which is very helpful, especially because I kept coming across ERO in there. I was like, where is this index?
I wanted to make sure people had that. You can like screenshot it on your phone, so you don't have to be flicking back and forth. Having read enough books about Spain and Myanmar, I became a big fan of glossaries. But yeah, I think those movements have successfully avoided that, right? Like they have not been sort of captured by a state because they needed to rely on that state for supplies. Like the relationship the Syrian Democratic Forces had with U.S. forces was like as partners, not as subsidiaries.
You've already talked a bit about the 3D printing in Myanmar, but it would be kind of cool to just sort of talk about, well, actually scratch that. I want to talk about fifth generation warfare. No, I'm just f***ing with you. Okay.
Okay.
Just kidding.
I was like, I'm not ready to talk about that.
Okay. No, but I do kind of want to talk a little bit about some of the 3D printing innovations and the communication between different war zones and different, like, ideally liberatory movements. I'm sure if stuff is free and open source, then who knows who's reading it and using it. But there's been innovations in the production of parts for tourniquets that have been able to be produced in Palestine, for instance, which is the generation of tourniquets that have been developed since the global war on terror, and their application has saved so many lives compared to like when I took advanced wilderness first aid in like 1998, they were like, don't put a tourniquet on anything you don't want to fall off.
Right. Yeah.
And it's amazing. Like, you know, it's not a foolproof thing, but it saves lives and people can actually mass manufacture them now. But drone parts, tourniquets, firearms, the plans and the models for these have been, and the innovations have been traded and shared, as well as the information about how to set up manufacturing has been traded between units in Ukraine and in Myanmar and in Rojava, and I'm assuming in other conflict zones as well, or like innovations with radio technology. Like there's been all of these small militaries, counter-state units that have been able to employ these things for saving lives or for more effectively surveilling or striking back at larger infrastructure or larger armies. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about this, like networking, information sharing, and innovation.
Yeah. I think a lot of it happens like in an indirect way, right? Because it's free and open source. Like someone can develop something, share it back. And the example would be, you know, I have a whole chapter where I talk about the 3D printed guns, or about the weapons generally that have been developed. And I've interviewed the surviving designer of the sort of the gun that really defines this, which is the FGC-9 Mark II. FGC stands for gun control, if you're wondering. 9 is the caliber of the round. And I think what's really interesting about this is it's not a person who was particularly engaged in the revolution in Myanmar, and that gun printing community was not particularly engaged in Burmese politics, right, in 2021. But it's been quite sweet to see these people who there are certainly people who are involved in the making or the designing of these 3D printed guns who are just interested in things from a mechanical way. Like I can relate to that. I like how things work. I like to work on my own vehicles, like to fix things, right? And I'm not very good with electronics, so I like it when something makes a small explosion and then stuff moves, right? And it's pretty much cars and firearms and some other stuff. But I'm just interested in that. I like to look at cross sections of engines and things and how they work. So like some of these people who are interested in that, and they happen to live in the United States, where it was not illegal for them to apply that knowledge to the creation of firearms. And I think many of them, you know, I don't particularly know their politics, but clearly they believe that one should be able to manufacture the means of defending oneself. And they felt that it was important the state should not have the monopoly on that. And so those people began developing these guns and sharing them openly. And then it's kind of heartwarming to watch heartwarming is the wrong word, right? Because these are machines for killing people. But to watch young people in Myanmar pop up on this subreddit where people are talking about it and just be like, hey, I'm trying this, it's not working. And people be like, oh, adjust your printer settings or what have you. And then, you know, start posting pictures. And then, like, I remember when they started posting pictures, me being like, that person's not in America. That's, you know, that's clearly somewhere else. And then, you know, then be like, yeah, well, this is who we are. And then to see that community embrace that revolution has been quite heartwarming. I think especially in America, the gun community can be incredibly toxic, right, and incredibly bigoted. And so it was nice to see parts of that community to not do that, right, to support their liberation in whatever terms that they want to be liberated. And this goes far beyond like machines for killing people, right? Like you talked about the Gaza tourniquet, right? It's developed by some folks called Galea, and that is being used to save lives because as you said, these tourniquets, which were developed during the global war on terror era, the most dominant one is called the combat application tourniquet, right, the CAT, for reasons that probably aren't to do with the fact that combat is in its name, it is embargoed for entry into Palestine, right? So people are reusing them there very frequently. And so this 3D printed tourniquet gives people the ability to save lives anywhere they have a 3D printer, right? I guess maybe these movements are united by the first come to know of each other, maybe when looking at this technology, right, and the sharing of technology. But what I think is beautiful is that they've moved beyond that. So, like, if we look in Kareni State in particular, right, which is a part of Myanmar on the eastern side, if people are looking at a map, they could look like Damoso and find it near there. We've seen the KNDF, right, the Kareni Nationalities Defense Force. I think it's interesting that it's nationalities plural, not nationality, right? Like, it's not a national liberation movement. It's a nationalities. So they're consciously like internationalist, I guess, in their like, if I was being academic, I would hyphenate between inter and national.
But like recognizing that a lot of different people exist within this state that is called this, that happens to be named after one of the ethnic groups. Yeah.
Yeah. And they wish to defend that plurality rather than extinguish it. Right. They have made these statements, like, and I write about these in the book, but like I remember waking up in Rojava to my phone going mental, and it being these videos from Myanmar at a time when they too were under attack, right? Being like, we see that your revolution is under threat, and our revolution, we want you to know that we're here in solidarity with you, and we see you, and we've learned from you more than maybe you're aware, that we admire the example that you have given us, and that, like, this exchange has been very beautiful because both of them approach it from a place of humility. Like, within days of that video coming out, the people in Rojava were reading about Myanmar, right? There is still reporting in the Kurdish press about the revolution in Myanmar. And it was really beautiful to see the people in Myanmar saying, like, hey, we have progress to make in gender terms, right? We see where you are and we want that. But we're not there, but we admire that. Like, a really genuine, humble, and like, a solidarity that really comes from two groups of people wanting to achieve liberation, not from, you know, just these open... The UN writes letters saying it's deeply concerned all the time, but they don't really care. They don't see each other as people, right? And these two groups did. And then from there, we've seen other statements of solidarity, right? Like, a statement was returned by the YPG and the YPJ in Rojava to the KNDF and to the women of Myanmar. We now see the KNDF made a statement of solidarity with the children of Palestine, and it was a particularly beautiful statement. We've seen more and more statements about solidarity with Rojava. We now see internationalists who have been in Rojava fighting in Myanmar, right, and bringing with them this idea that, like, a revolution that isn't a women's revolution, right? That doesn't contain, or like, if the revolution is not in some sense about women, then it's not really a revolution, right? If we're not liberating women, then what is the point of liberating territory, right? If people are living in subjugation in our families, why are we bothering to liberate countries? And so you see women in Chinland fighting, you know, alongside, or in distinct units, right, using the same salute that we see from the YPG and the YPJ, the peace sign, and like, consciously emulating that model. So, like, while the exchange, I guess, has been about technology, it's also the other things that they have learned from each other, which I think are really special. And that, like, throughout 5 years of war in Myanmar now, they've shown a capacity to care. Like, and just to be clear for people who aren't maybe as familiar with history, this is a country in which genocide has happened and has continued to be perpetrated against a Muslim majority ethnic group, the Rohingya, right? And so this is a country where Islamophobia has deep roots. Really horribly bigoted stuff was said, you know, not even 10 years ago that led to that genocide, right? So to see people coming from that milieu and saying, like, a revolution that isn't for everyone isn't a revolution that's worth being part of, and therefore we stand in solidarity with Palestine, with Muslim people here. To see, like, young women in hijab fighting alongside, like, young Buddhist men, it's an incredible leap forward, right, that only comes from this exchange and this kind of realization that all those struggles are connected.
Yeah, and I've kept you on for a long time. I've only got a few more questions. And
that's
this is a very big subject. Clearly, these are all really big subjects. People should check out the book and the number of other books that are written on these subjects. But one revolutionary horizon that you explore in the conflict in Against the State is that of how heteropatriarchy plays out among the anarchistic actors. Clearly, there's there's the YPJ. The women's revolution is one of the foundations of the Rojava project. And you described this one instance, this one image of these people fighting alongside of each other from not only different probably ethnicities, different faith practices, different genders. Can you talk about sort of what you saw including warts and all, as you want to address in these three instances that you cover, how gender and, if you want to throw it in there too, like sexuality sort of play into the revolutionary horizons of these moments?
Yeah, definitely. And I think we should be it's right to be, like I said before, to give criticism from a place of solidarity in these cases. Like, first of all, there should be more Burmese women in my book. I had a couple of folks who I'd wanted to talk to, and it just didn't pan out to be the right thing to do to use their voices. But obviously the revolution in Rojava kind of stands out as the one that is the women's revolution, right? The revolution is for everyone, but it's very much led by women. And I think we should look back at Spain and we should learn from that, right? Because yes, women were part of the militia, and in many cases they were deeply respected comrades in arms, right? But in other cases they were saddled with this dual burden of being, yes, you can fight, but also we expect you to cook. And that is something that should be criticized, right? Like, it's not commensurate with equality to do that. And I think that criticism has been raised more about the communist formations, where perhaps this maybe was more obviously the case. It's this famous line that I opened that chapter with, like, I didn't join the militia to die with a dishcloth in my hand, which I think is a very reasonable critique to make, right? And I think one could make the same critique of some... So, like, if you look at a lot of Burmese formations, there are women's fighting formations, there are entirely women formations. There are also formations where women tend to do things like the boot camp instructors in some formations will be women, right? There are women's drone squads, that kind of thing. But there are also formations where women are not taking on combat or frontline roles. And I think that is an area where, like, improvement could be made, right? If we're fighting to liberate people, we should be fighting to liberate everyone. Otherwise, it's not worth all the people who are going to die. And likewise, with when we talk about, like, cis-heteropatriarchy, right? I am aware of trans women fighting in both of the contemporary revolutions as women, and they're living as themselves and they're accepted for who they are. And I think that's beautiful. But I think that those revolutions, they are not often centered or even spoken about, right? I directly asked the Kongresstar, is the Kurdish women's movement, right? We spoke about transphobia because it has occurred that people will try and speak on behalf of the Kurdish women's movement in a transphobic fashion, and they reject that, right? They believe that if you're with them, you're with them. And I wanted to ask them, give them a chance to speak on that, because I think people seek to speak for them. But I'm glad that they spoke about that, like, openly and very emphatically. And I think that these revolutions should continue to do that, to make it very clear where they stand on these issues, right? And the queer youth of Myanmar have been embraced by the revolution because, like, there wasn't really a place for them in the dictatorship, right? Like, the circumstances were such that the only way for them to continue being who they are was to join the fight. but that the revolution has embraced them, and you see things that you wouldn't have seen even from EROs, right? Like the EROs in their encounter with queer youth have realized that these people are their community, that they are us, right? And so that has been beautiful to witness, but there are probably also areas where those people are having a pretty rough time. Like, they are being who they are, but they're maybe not always having, like, there's still probably growth, and I think that growth sometimes takes time, right? I should acknowledge that. But I still think, just like in Spain, like, we should look back at that example and use it to guide how we go forward, and we should be very aware of the prevalence of cis heteropatriarchy and the way it can creep back in. You saw this even, like, you know, as units begin to formalize, not necessarily militarize, but, you know, they have names and things. Sometimes you'll see, like it's fine for women and men to separate, right? That's a YPG, YPJ model. But as long as the women don't just disappear, which, you know, sometimes it's hard for me to see, right? Because I'm only seeing these people through their public communications. But one would hope that they would look at the example of Rojava and see that one could center women in one's public communications and could center their liberation in everyone's liberation and still succeed. And it's reasonable to demand that. And it's certainly reasonable for young women in Myanmar to demand that, right?
Yeah, as you say, like, assessing our compromises for how far they draw us from our ideals and values is critical and should be done in a comradely and honest manner. I noted that the book didn't discuss questions of child soldiers or conscription in anarchistic armies, though in Spain there was the question of anarchists leaving the fight. And I guess, like, a similar one was that you brought up, where someone in, I guess, in the SDF had stepped away from their unit and had to deal with the consequences with their comrades. But yeah, as far as the topic of child soldiers or forced conscription, I wonder if you could talk about, in these three scenarios, a little bit what you understand and how anarchistic or comradely groups thought or dealt with these things.
Yeah, I mean, conscription is not compatible with anarchism, right? Like, forcing someone at the point of a gun to do something is kind of the sine qua non of the state, right? Like if you're doing that, then you have become the state now. I think that's pretty cut and dried. I have heard of allegations of it in Myanmar, but none that I've really, and certainly not with the units I speak to. Like, I'm not aware of that. With regards to young people fighting child soldiers, right, I think we ought to bring some more precision to the terms. Like, no young person should be forced to fight against their will, right? No person, period, of any age should be forced to fight against their will. I am aware of situations where young women in Rojava have left their families and kind of come towards the movement. If you see, like, if they're in a family situation where maybe women are not as liberated and valued as they might be in the movement, and if those young women are 16 or 17, then they may end up, like, in either training with or in military formations. And I think in those instances, it's reasonable to want those young people to be protected, because they are still young, but also to respect their autonomy as people who can make their own decisions. And it is not unfeasible that their families would then accuse the SDF of having child soldiers or something. I think in those instances, what's happening is defensible. If there is, like, either forced recruitment or even unforced recruitment of people who are much younger than that, then that's very problematic, right? Every time I'm in a conflict zone, I'm reminded how young soldiers are. Right, even in conventional militaries, they are very young. They are just out of high school in the US military, right? In Britain, you can join before your high school leaving age, right? I think you can be 15 or 16, right? So it's not that states don't do this, they do. I mean, you can't deploy until you're older, to be clear. But there is somewhere there a line that should not be crossed, right? It is abusive to ask young people to fight when they're not really old enough to know the consequences of fighting, right? And when they will have to live for the rest of their lives with the consequences of that, right? Even if they do survive. At the same time, I understand that when communities are under attack, people want to defend them, and so that they might ask for that. So I think it's a complicated topic, but it's not to, like, absolve responsibility, right? If young people are being made to fight, or even beneath a certain age or a maturity level, I think it's probably a better way of saying it, allowed to fight, then that is wrong. But once young people reach a certain maturity level, we ought to respect their autonomy too and their ability to make their own choices. So, like, I think it's a topic that we just have to approach, like, I don't know how to say this, like, with as long as we have a genuine solidarity with each other and genuinely want the best for each other, then we can approach the nuances. And if we don't, then we have to have rules. And if we have to have rules, then we shouldn't be letting children fight. And that's okay to maybe have those rules if we don't have a, you know, if the structures that we have in place can't be such that nuance is allowed. But, you know, and there is sometimes nuance, especially in the case of women who might be escaping homes that are either abusive or just don't respect their autonomy. And then coming towards a movement which they see as fighting for their autonomy and then wanting to be involved in that, especially in the times of the Islamic State, I understand. I remember a little girl in Rojava. We were playing football and she was just really... I scored a goal, I think, went for a high five. She just completely... she just walked up to me and, like, punched my hand. And I was like, oh, fair enough, okay. I guess I wasn't much help, really. But she punched very, like, inexpertly, right? So I was like, would you like to practice punching a bit more while we're here? So we're, like, throwing a punch. And, you know, within 5 minutes, I'm regretting my choice, right? It's my palms just getting smashed by a bunch of, like, eight-year-olds. But, like, a young woman who grows up in a society which sees women as being capable of fighting, but maybe in a family which doesn't see women as capable of autonomy, I can see where that tension would arise. There is a way that we can respect both of those things as long as we approach the topic with the understanding that, you know, no one should be compelled to do anything that they don't wish to do. That's what the state does, right? That's the whole point of us fighting. That's the whole point of all my friends dying.
Yeah. And then, but there is, like, in these situations, there, without being physically coercive, there can be manipulation of younger people, especially if they're, like, if the choice would be hypothetical. I mean, we're getting into hypotheticals, and I don't want to go too far into it, but, you know, leaving a bad situation, the alternative is to fight for the women's revolution, here's a gun and a uniform. Like, there are malajin, there are, like, houses, women's houses set up.
Yes, there should be... Yeah, safe places to go.
Where if...
Yeah. Yeah. And there are, right?
Like, it was pointed to me by a recent guest, Leila Al-Shami, that there are continued criticisms of the autonomous administration areas as relating to or allowing organizations that affiliate with them to recruit youth. And so...
Yeah. I think some of those organizations, like, it's not directly the SDF often, right? But it's these organizations that affiliate with them and share an ideology that have recruited youth in a militaristic way. And, like, I don't think that recruiting children to do that isn't really respecting their like, autonomy. I think it's not right because they I don't know what the phrase is, like, proselytizing to them in a way that, like, glorifies militarization. That's, again, what I've spoken about this, right? That's, we don't want to do that. We don't want to glorify that aesthetic or the practice of violence. And I think places like Malajin are really important for that, right? Places where young women can go and be safe but not have to make a commitment to do anything they don't wish to do, right? Because, again, if we're asking them to move from, like, one structure which makes choices on their behalf and doesn't allow them to be autonomous to another structure by saying these are your only two choices, and we're not respecting their autonomy, right? And that is not, to me, compatible with the way I would want anarchists to approach the world. That is not compatible with women's liberation either, right? Like, I know if they are older and then they choose to do so, that's fine, but they should be able to experience autonomy first without that being the cost of it, and then decide from a place where they are autonomous and not constrained what they wish to do. So I think it's very reasonable for people like Leila to give that criticism, and I think it's one that should be taken to heart, right? Like, one of the foundational principles of the revolution in Rojava is tekmil, and I think that this is one of the areas where I spoke about before, where if this is occurring, we should identify it and call it out, and we should give criticism about that.
And there's I'll link a couple of human rights organizations articles that relate these criticisms in the show notes for people to read further.
Yeah.
And because you did bring up tekmil, I guess the second to last question that I wanted to ask was about some of the tools available for internal conflict resolution and decision making in fighting structures. Mm-hmm. Like, what are, tekmil is one of these, I think, three levels of decision making conflict resolution related to crit self crit, sort of that. Exist in the military structures, but I wonder if you could talk about these, some interesting approaches towards justice as relates to the harms done by friend and foe, and what remains to be improved on. Like, obviously, you're viewing from the outside.
Yeah, yeah. Like, it's crit, self-crit, not in the, like, Maoist way, but, like, I mean, that's where it derives from, right? This movement has moved through a status.
But if you're thinking Japanese Red Army film, this is not them up in the mountains, like, purging each other.
No, it's not. Yeah, they have moved past that paradigm, as they would say. But I think this is one of the things where I really, because I've been part of so many mutual aid projects where there has not been success in accountability, right? And that has destroyed the whole project. It's vital. And I think TechMill provides that, right? So TechMill, it's a meeting, essentially, depending on the exact nature of the TechMill. So TA does it a bit differently to the YPG, YPJ. It's either facilitated or run by the person who is the commander, and then that people will give a crit and a self-crit, right? But everybody cannot criticize the same person. We can't all just pile on one person, right? If criticism's been given, it can't be repeated. And then